Sure, y'all come on in. Take your shoes off, sit on down.
Y'all listening to
In the Corner, back by the woodpile.
My guest back by the woodpile today is Nashville-based poet Christine Hall. As I was trying to write this introduction, I realized two things. One, I couldn't for the life of me remember how I first met Christine. She just seemed to always be a smiling encourager wherever I happened to wander around Nashville. Two, sometimes introductions, especially if people are much more graceful than myself with language, are as lame as wet cardboard. That said, I'll kindly close my mouth now.
Imitating flatters. Beautiful mockingbird. Thank you for making fun of insomniac me, and the city bus, and the cat, and the sirens, and the horns, and the radio, and the car alarm. You really are hilarious. Everything as loud as you is devastating in some way.
So first off, do you care to tell me what the poem is about? I mean, there's a lot of imagery there, and so...
Yeah. The poem was written in San Francisco. I had lived there, and then when I went back, I visited a friend whose window opened to a courtyard, and there was a mockingbird that had a 45-minute repertoire. Every morning around 5 a.m., and we had been out very late the night before, and we were just settling down. Every time I felt like I was on the edge of sleep, something would happen, and then when I finally just felt so exhausted, I was hoping somebody would knock me out with a baseball bat or something to that effect, the bird launched into its repertoire and turned a situation where I was escalating into anger and just something that I could only view as humorous, so I was expressing my appreciation for that.
Okay. So you were out in San Francisco. Where are you originally from? We're in Tennessee as we speak.
I'm from upstate New York.
Okay.
I was raised in a town called Queensbury, very small town. The elementary, middle, and high school were all on the same campus. And my parents brought me here when I was 14.
Okay. What was your first impression when you got down here?
Well, we drove down in a big Ford Econoline van with all our stuff, and our first stop in Tennessee was a little country market, and it had the rocking chair porch, and there were some old men whittling wood, and they had beards midway down their chest, and one followed me inside and said something to me in an accent I could not understand. And I said, "Mommy!" So that was my first impression.
Right. Yeah.
It was as classic as I could have imagined.
Well, good. I'm glad you had that experience.
Yeah. However, when we did get to the city, I was very fond of saying Nashville smelled like a city that was coming awake. And now I'm very fond of admiring the awakeness I see around me.
Okay. So, well, let's talk about Nashville for a minute.
I would notice the artists coming in to fill these empty spaces that were here in the wasteland. You know, much like you see when there is an affordable landscape, a lot of creative sorts will come in and make use of that.
Right.
So I noticed that happening. There was a coffee house downtown briefly called Jitters, and people would gather in this living room sort of environment with a piano, and we were all strangers, but, you know, we would be talking together and having conversations and, you know, caffeine-fueled jam sessions. It was fantastic. Uh-huh. It was very exciting to be a part of something like that.
Okay, when did you start writing poetry?
In first grade, I had a long walk home from the bus stop, and this song started pouring out of me. You know, it's written like a poem. I've not ever written another song, aside from, you know, just making up little ditties for my kids. It poured through me, and, you know, there was a sorrow to it that was beyond anything that I can explain a six-year-old feeling, And then there was this profound hope, and I felt like I was expressing my feelings, and yet something that was even greater than me, something beyond me that I could grow into. It was a powerful feeling to be able to express myself in words that seemed like they were more than me.
Do you remember what the impetus was for you to have that feeling?
I was lonely. You know, I was walking alone home from school, and I didn't have that many friends. We were a very poor family and very religious, and we actually weren't supposed to have what we called worldly friends. Even at that age, romance was very interesting to me, and I was pining for my true love, and I wrote a song about it.
Okay. Do you still have it?
I know the song.
Can you?
I don't have much of a singing voice. I'll give it a go, though. Oh,
yeah. Yeah,
it'll be a little girl.
I don't have much
voice.
Of an interviewing voice, but here I am. So.
Let's see. Oh, so long ago, I dreamt of happiness. Oh, it came like the sun and it went like the rain. How I wish I could see happiness again. Once upon a time, I was with you, my love, but now you are gone, and I dedicate this song to all who have loved but lost. You said it was true, you'd be back to renew the love that we had when we first made our vows. Now that I miss you and I want you back, you're gone from my sight and my whole world is black.
You wrote that when you were six?
I did.
Whoa.
And I did not set well with it ending so sad, so I added another couple of verses to it a couple years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, my next poem, when I was in fourth grade, is about blackness as well. You know, I think we all received the same assignment across the United States to write one of those what is poems. Beautiful is, or blue is, or so mine was, a color is. And I chose black and I did not follow the rules, so I did not get a good grade. However, I do really like the poem.
Okay.
Blackness, darkness, all around, a feeling that you're lost and never will be found. The sound of thunder booming in the night, giving small children a terrible fright. A squaw's hair blowing in the breeze while riding on her stallion, flying past the trees. Smooth black velvet on my favorite dress, eating licorice candy that makes my teeth a mess.
Wow.
So I got a 50 on it because I didn't follow the what is format.
That's great.
Thank you. I thought it was a pretty good one.
A little dark.
Very dark. I was a very dark child, but I was raised, with the fire and brimstone.
So
and
you that's what it came from?
It was the biblical imagery, and I was just very depressed. We lived in squalor, and I was very aware of that. We drove a rusted tin can car and lived in a rusted tin can trailer, and our lawn was dirt, and, I would immerse myself in the wilderness. I would go and wander the mountain or the creek, and that was where the riches were for me. I would eat berries, found. That was...
It's funny you say that, because just today I was listening to something about the Essenes, where the Dead Sea Scrolls came from, and they believed in the apocalypse was very imminent, and they end up being right for their case, because they end up all being slaughtered. So it's funny that, but as a child in the 20th century...
Oh, yeah.
But...
Well, and I would have apocalypse dreams in my 20s for a long time, and they were working backwards toward the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And it happened that the height of it was when I was in an abusive relationship, and that was my own personal apocalypse.
Sure.
So it's interesting.
Do you think it helped? I mean, were you given some kind of tools to deal with your own apocalypse?
I've read a lot about how dreams can be a practice realm, how they will... disable the part of animals' brains, for instance, that keep them paralyzed in dreams, and they will observe what they do, and it's practice for hunting and things like that. I feel like dreams are a practice realm. I feel like I get a heads up. I feel like maybe my brain is decoding some subconscious information I have, putting all the factors together and giving me a reading of, where this is heading. I think a lot of times we know exactly what we're doing, but we don't allow ourselves to see it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You want to read another poem from your book? And your book is called Waking Up God, correct?
Yes. Yes. My first book is Waking Up God. I am in the process of publishing book two, which is Paper Stick Poems and Short Stories.
Okay. Do you mind explaining the title, by the way?
Waking Up God. Yeah. It could go either way.
Okay.
You could wake up and say, oh, I'm God. Let me create my life today. Or you could say that God was sleeping and rested on a seventh day, and now he is waking up.
Okay.
It's time to create some new stuff.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so you're ready for the new creation. All right. We got it all in here. Apocalypse is creation, you know? Let's get all that stuff in between.
So. Never mind. I am in love with your soul. I don't know what that means. Nor what a soul is, exactly. Except, I don't know exactly what it is I love about you. I love your looks. But I'd love you without them. I love your voice. But I'd love you without it. I love your attitude. But I'd love you even if that changed too. Simply, my soul fell in love with your soul. And I don't know what that means. But it feels true. All these things I love about you aren't what I love about you. I love them because I love you. And I don't know what that means, but it feels true.
Wow. Can I ask you who was the recipient of that?
A true love.
Okay, sure, okay. Well, that brings up another question. Now you perform, especially in Nashville and the spoken word circuit, I would say you're a regular.
Yeah.
Obviously, at least I know when I write, it's usually about something personal, and inevitably we're going to write about somebody else or how they've affected our lives, good or bad. When you have read in public, has someone that you've written about been in the audience, like happenstance?
Yeah. Yes! Oh my goodness, one of my first times reading, I read a poem that might not be appropriate for this,
yeah.
And he walked in. He did not even catch a word. He walked in like right as it was finishing.
Oh, okay.
But I wrote it down and I handed it to him. And I said, I wanted you to know you missed it. I did a poem about you. I hadn't seen him, you know, since we'd had our brief interaction.
Uh-huh.
It was an interesting experience, though. It was cool.
How did he take it? I mean, was it a little bit, I won't say negative, but I mean, was it a little bit of...
It was harsh.
Okay.
I feel he was flattered by it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he like put a
you know, he made an impact.
Yeah, so, okay, well.
Yeah, we all, you know, we all want to inspire art, don't we?
Yeah.
I'm really super specific and I make sure that I am honest to a painstaking degree in the same manner of kindness that I would use on myself. And I do use teeth on myself, so, you know, I do want people to cut through and say it as it is. I want to hear what's really going on. I love that.
Okay.
I love to face it. So I do it, and I do it with the awareness that at some point I'm going to die and somebody's going to read this, even if,
sure.
You know, it's not published from one end of the earth.
Right.
It's at some point, you know, it'll be heard and it very well may offend, and I do my best to face up to that as it goes.
When you first came to Nashville when you were 14, did you look back at New York and think, oh man, I wish I was back there? Or did you use it to draw from to write? Or that said, when you were in California, right, did you look back at Tennessee or New York and think, oh man? Because I've noticed that a lot of people I've talked with that we all tend to have this like, oh man, I miss this or that. And you tend to pine for wherever you're never at. Did you have that experience?
I was looking forward more than back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I certainly, you know, see myself as the snowball effect happening. I pick up layers of the earth wherever I roll across, and every once in a while, you know, I'll punch down into myself and catch a sample of all these layers I've collected along the way. I draw upon it constantly, yet I'm always looking forward. At the same time, Nashville's home. You know, I have people inviting me to go work in an orchard in Costa Rica, you know, and that sounds like heaven. At the same time, I have enjoyed watching Nashville come awake in this creative way where it seems to be the Mecca right now for many different expressions to come to fruition and to play together, you know, and to inspire each other to grow. And, you know, I just love it so much. I really love it here. Wherever I've gone, Nashville has had a magnetic pull to me.
I bet you.
Yeah. Cavalry. Four men on top of a building. I was one of them, watching from above, watching the man I was push two off in quick succession. Before the other noticed, they fell towards the ground, clouded in mist or distance, and the third man turned as I approached him, about to push again. They were bad dudes, I could tell it. Then he asked, would I be his mentor? A bad man in Mexico, I followed him, stole his cash, laptop, a magical piece of technology. Had to hop a plane in his name and needed protection from him heading me off at the airport. So I visited a witch doctor and she did her business without requesting payment. We were in cahoots, yet I spread out all my pendants and searched for one to give her. A broken horse head, an owl missing and a rhinestone eye. None of them sufficient as the payment that wasn't requested. I visited her granddaughter, tucked into bed, who was also my son. She said they'd kill her in the night. I wasn't so certain. She was my long-lost friend, and she wondered if it was too late to get back with her husband, and I answered, you can have whatever you choose, like always. Her eyes could have rolled. Instead, they flashed, and I quoted Caroline, you are the only one here. Do you understand what that means? We did, and cried at the magnitude of our freedom and loneliness. The wallet was made of fine upholstery leather, styled to fit a checkbook, and both pockets full of $1, $20, $100, and $120 bills. Some of them surely were marked.
Okay. I gotta ask, is there a story behind that one?
Oh, that was a dream.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say, you're down in Mexico, but...
It has great meaning for me. I love analyzing my dreams. Okay. I have a parallel life that I carry out in my dreams. Okay. And occasionally overlap into some of my friends' realms as well.
Okay. Okay, so analyze yourself via this poem.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the time, I was quite concerned with whether I was good or bad.
Mm.
Yeah, I see that playing out. And, you know, I often employ mischievous ways in achieving my end, and I wonder about that. I am playful. I like tricks from time to time, and I wonder about that. However, I also wonder whether I could be questioning my own nature too much, and whether it's not better to just go with it and be who I am, which, incidentally, from the time of 6, aside from being so taken with ideas of romance, I wanted to be an assassin. So, yeah, I have this darkness, I have these teeth, and I also have great love and compassion, and it's important to me that I embody that honestly.
And when you say assassin, like who did you want to assassinate, or what kinds of
child
people?
Molesters.
I see.
I was very aware. We heard in church about this, and I knew of someone who had been molested, and I decided that I would be a photojournalist, and I would wear a wig, and I would be in crowds, and I would find people, and I would kill them, and then I would slip off my wig and slip into the crowd, and that would be that. And then later I decided that it wasn't up to me to determine the value of any one life. So that was a weight lifted.
Wow. Okay, we're going to play a piece real quick. We did a little experiment where we took some of Christine's words and put a little music.
It's not raining anymore, which is good because I'm trying to be the desert. I want to use all my resources wisely and defend my most precious fruits with spikes. I want to not care what people think when they have to go 127 miles without convenience. I am angry.
I am angry,
which is an uncomfortable feeling. He says I've been trying to get comfortable as long as he's known me. He hasn't known me long.
It's true, I don't stay still for long. I'm constantly shifting my weight or kicking up dust, changing my patterns to be sure he never finds me in the same place twice. The sun has broken through the persistent drizzle, and now I'm wet and dry at once, which is an uncomfortable feeling. Every time I get a rush of wetness down there, I check if I'm bleeding again. I thought, when he kicked me in the chest and I felt it trickle down into my belly, that might be it. I thought I might have asked for it. Now the rain keeps coming to wash away the jolt. What charged atmosphere brought on that strike? And I keep trying to fill this scorched cavity with comfort that there is life yet in me. Somewhere on my grounds, a shaman is sending up smoke signals, telling me his medicine is ready to ease this distress. And I am not about to take it, because I am afraid not to be angry. I'm afraid not to define my strength like this. I'm afraid of what I will see if I peel back the prickly layers to show the luscious fruit. The right poke might start the flow again, but I want to believe I've been bled dry. I want my dried skin baked clean to cracking this time, and I don't want to quench a thing. My want has become my need, burning, and what I don't want is any more miserable sniveling. Still, no comfort yet. My labors feel barren, and my anger can't be with anyone but myself for coming here. So I'm afraid of the rain, of what it will expose and feed. I'm afraid to get comfortable just to dry out harshly in the heat of our next exchange. I'm afraid there's a life left inside me to care for, and I'm afraid to nourish it because I care so much how it will grow and overtake me. I know the rainy season is coming. I'm just afraid to change because I want it so desperately. I'm afraid to let go of my anger because this is exactly what I asked for, but not nearly how I imagined. I'm afraid not to bleed, and I'm even more afraid to taste what's sweet, because I know the danger of a pointed defense and what it's protecting. A little bit of poison is called medicine. It stimulates and reveals things that are otherwise a mystery. I'm afraid of the softness of comforting, because I might take too much and grow complacent. I'm afraid of wanting the medicine, because I don't know how much I need, and I've never trusted another to dose me. I'm afraid I'll need too much, and there won't be enough, and I'll be left wanting. So it's come to this. I'm angry, but what's more, I'm afraid. I'm dried out, but I'm soaking. I'm covering my wound, but I'm still bleeding. It's trickling through these cracks, and he can smell it, and he seems intent on attacking again. I'm not going to be on the defensive anymore. So I'm going to have a drink of water, go get washed up, and forget this dream. It's only reality if you let it be.
So, first of all, can you explain the story behind this piece? I know it's a bit painful.
I don't remember that, yeah. My first marriage, I fell in love again rather quickly and intensely with a man. I could see the danger under his surface, and that impressed me. I thought to myself that he must be really strong and spectacular to keep demons like that tethered. When I became pregnant, he was convinced it wasn't his, even though we had planned the child, and he became abusive. I learned more and more about him as it went. As I had become pregnant only 6 months into our relationship, and I learned he had already done this with two women before, and he had two other children, and both of the mothers had restraining orders against him. And I was determined to play it out in a unique manner, and to stay with it and work through it. Ultimately, I learned that Some people are very determined to repeat patterns, and they will hear and experience things according to their own storyline, no matter how hard you work to put something else out there.
Do you believe that this fella could have changed?
Everybody's still open to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's still open to him.
Yeah. Are you still aware of his existence? I mean,
you know, periodically throughout our son's life, we have gotten together and had visits.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in and out. The last time, however, he wanted to meet at our home, and I expressed that I was not comfortable with that, and he told me to kill myself.
Yikes.
So, as it stands, that's where it is.
Gotcha.
I leave room for us all to grow.
That's very gracious.
A lot of my work is concerned with our society's mistrust of femininity, and I do tend to take a brutal tone. However, lately I've been interested in pushing myself to a more compassionate and gentle place. It's important to me that I am not always asking for women to toughen up and to be stronger than what's thrown at them to overcome. I don't think that that's necessarily something we need to demand anymore. I think we may need to take a moment and pause and reflect on the beauty of gentility and to allow ourselves some time and space to develop these subtle gifts that femininity allows us to experience, because we all have, you know, these masculine and feminine ideals at play within ourselves and different ways that we express that and different things we're used to saying or seeing. And I really enjoy questioning that from time to time. I would love to be able to speak to someone who may be oversensitized by traumatic events in their past and didn't react in the manner that I did. Mm-hmm. I got very combative. Mm-hmm. Some people do not. Some people withdraw. Some people are not ready to face it head on. And while I have been very direct, I would like to find a way to do that in a way that's tempered and more sensitive to what we all need to heal, you know, and different medicines serve different members of our community. I would like to reach into a new territory in the work that I do forthcoming that is more delicate. Echoing the last blast. Hate is a hot Berber carpet lining the front inside wall of my chest, made of mostly synthetic fiber, softly scratching yarns, doused in comforting irritants, ground in retardant, powdery white shadows of the nuisance dust incident, atomic shit on astroturf, flecks of turd tracked in monogram treads, the familiar pincushion landing pad on which I press, drunk and grateful for a point to spin against. Any object at rest is still in motion, and stillness allows for movement under the apparent surface, changes in chemical state and affiliation, concentration. Up close there is room to name particles per cubic centimeter, red 40, yellow lake 5, citric acid crystals, 6 corn fabrications, naturally and artificially flavored sprays of vomit, melted ice cubes laced with contraceptives, industrial byproduct, sleep aids. If this movie theater carpet is drenched in blood, and I name it hate, the same as a classroom where the teacher points at the gym, and children are still all at once hiding in cabinets, meeting sounds of hatred with silence, and a round of bullets push pins exit points, the front wall of my chest is stripped of carpet. Even the scared silent child evacuates my closeted heart, and the room changes its name. That's about the Sandy Hook shooting and references the movie theater shooting that happened not long before it.
Okay.
I was overwhelmed with a sensation of hate, which was very akin to what I imagined a shooter might feel, and it disturbed me, and I needed to find a way to express it. And at the time, I was exploring the ways that tragedies were inspiring people to act, and I was hoping for finding a way to be proactive.
So you're going to read us one last piece, right?
I am.
So do you mind give us the backdrop of this?
This is metaphorical largesse, and it was an exercise in collecting notes that I had been taking over a few weeks, little snippets and phrases that would come to me and I'd write them down, or here in my office, as you can see, they're right on my walls, so part of it is written right over there.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Have just things that I jotted down, and traveling along the same thought lines, and they were intuitively connected, and when I pieced them all together, I hadn't intended them to be one poem, and yet that's how it turned out. Metaphorical Largesse, Part 1. Stepping into your heart, I noticed there's no roof to hit. I wasn't surprised, but amazed to find your spirit a redwood soaring into the vast. Love has a great view of everywhere. Part 2. The world is your castle. What does it matter if you are the queen, or you wash the queen's sheets, or you are a queen who washes her own sheets? You are the ghost in the machine, the man behind the curtain, the tooth fairy. No pressure. Part 3. When you are young and beautiful, you imagine someone rich and famous will discover and appreciate you. Then when no one picks you out of a phone booth like Kate Moss, and they don't even have phone booths anymore. I pretended to pass out in a phone booth at a Fugazi show once. I never shot heroin. That was a lie. Loud noises are exhausting, and I needed a nap. You have to pull out all your talents and parade them and pray you will notice your own beauty and not mourn your youth of opportunities wasted and waiting on the one. Look, you hold the magic arrow in your hand. Stick it in the first thing that moves you.
Very good. Very nice. You really went to a Fugazi show?
Oh, yeah. It was at 328 Performance Hall, if you remember that
place.
And they had that phone booth.
Yeah.
That was in my mid-teens as well. And, you know, I'd probably been going for a couple days. I did not get much sleep those years. And I was very tired, and I still kind of shut down in the midst of loud noises. So yeah, I thought it was cooler if I just pretended I was strung out and needed to pass out, but I just was...
So Ian McKay didn't come save you?
Oh, wow. I imagine he would have been more likely to kick my ass.
That's true.
Yeah.
I can see him doing that. All right. Thank you very much.
Mm. Thank you.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.